The following recording is offered by the Village Zendo. For more information, please visit villagezendo.org.
Oh, the chanting sounds really good tonight. Good evening, everyone. Good to see you. I noticed that we have a really nice mixture tonight of old hands and new faces. So some of what I'll be talking about tonight will be familiar to the old hands, and hopefully there'll be an introduction to the people who are new to one of the most important Chinese Zen masters of the Dong Dynasty, the latter part of the Dong Dynasty, a master called Zhao Zhou Songsen, maybe more popularly known by the Japanese version of his name, Master Joshu Kongshen. It's usually a little simpler to pronounce the Japanese. So the story of Joshu is a little unusual even in the history of Zen, because, you know, the normal pattern is for a monk to study with his master for a certain number of years and, you know, receive his master's approval. And then he goes off into the wilderness and founds his own temple, his own dojo on top of some lonely mountain. That's sort of the standard pattern, at least of those times. But Joshu didn't follow that pattern. He reached realization with his master Nanchuan quite early, probably when he was in his early 20s, working on the phrase, "Ordinary mind is the way." And after he achieved his great realization, he stayed on. He didn't leave the nest. And he stayed in his master's temple for basically almost another 40 years until his master died and Joshu was in his 60s. And even then, he didn't set up his own place. He went on a pilgrimage all over China, and his motto was, if I have something to teach a 100-year-old man, I'll vow to teach him. And if I have something to learn from a 5-year-old child, I'll study with him. And so in this sort of open-hearted spirit, he wandered all over the vast land of China, up and down mountains and through valleys and just wherever his feet took him. And that was another 15 years or so. And so if you're doing the math, Joshu is now in his 80s. And he finally settled down in the town which he took his name from, the town of Zhao Zhou, and founded a temple there. So he began teaching in his 80s, and according to legend anyway, he taught for 40 more years until he died at the age of 120. And these old stories, they're not as precise about numbers as we like to be in the West. So suffice it to say, whether you buy the 80 and the 120, he started teaching when he was quite old, and he lived for a real long time. So he had a long teaching career, even though he started late. This town that he was teaching in was renowned for a great stone bridge that crossed a river there. And so people either went to the town to see the bridge, which, by the way, still is there, or they, you know, they were seekers who heard about Zhao Zhou and went to see him. It was another idiosyncrasy of Zhao Zhou that he was not really a great, well, let's put it this way, he was challenged as to what is known as development, in other words, raising money for his temple. And so whenever a rich guy came and wanted to make a big donation, Zhao Zhou would abuse him and throw him out. And as a result, his temple was a mess. Everything was falling apart. One time they just plumb ran out of food, and the monks had to go into the woods and gather acorns and eat acorns. One time, Zhao Zhou was giving a Dharma talk, and the platform he was on, the leg broke. And he just got himself up off the ground, got a piece of twine, tied the leg up, sat back down on the platform, and went on speaking. So basically what you had there was a little old dried up Zen teacher teaching in probably one of the crummiest temples in China. And one day a monk who apparently had come from quite a distance to see the great master Zhao Zhou, well, you can imagine, you know, what he finds there, what he expects and what he finds there. And so he sat in front of Zhao Zhou and he said, you know, throughout China, the great stone bridge of Zhao Zhou is famous. And I've come to see it, but now that I've come all this way to see it, all I see is a shabby log bridge. So basically he's saying, I've come all this way. You know, he's using the bridge that the town was famous for as a metaphor. And he says, I've come all this way to see this great master, and all that I'm seeing is a shabby little old man in a falling apart robe in a crummy temple. All I see is a simple log bridge. And Zhao Zhou said, you only see the log bridge. You don't see the stone bridge. And the monk asked, what is the stone bridge? And Zhao Zhou said, it lets asses cross, it lets horses cross. So, what is he getting at here? I think, I always think it helps to sort of connect with these koans, to associate them with our Zazen practice. So when we're doing Zazen, oftentimes we're in the mindset of this monk sitting on this cushion, especially when we go on retreat, but it could be any time. We're sitting on our cushion and we're meditating real hard and we're trying to have realization, to get enlightened. And lo and behold, every once in a while, we have a really great experience on the cushion, and we go, whoa, okay, now I'm seeing the great stone bridge. Got it. But, so, you know, you walk around on cloud nine for a few days, and just like any drug experience, it slowly wears off, and you're back with your same old mind, busy, anguished, feeling inadequate, feeling like you don't know what the hell you're doing this for in the first place. You're back with that simple log bridge, which is yourself, which is your life, which is your reality. And of course, if you're like me, you waste a lot of time beating yourself over the head at retreat after retreat and trying to get that great stone bridge to appear again. Where is it? Where is it? You only see the stone bridge. You only see the log bridge. You don't see the stone bridge. So what Joshu is implying here is maybe there is no separation between the simple log bridge of our ordinary mind state and the great stone bridge of realization, of enlightenment, of all that wonder that we think if we just work hard enough, we can attain, we can grab for ourselves. Maybe those old Zen masters weren't so screwy after all. Maybe there is nothing to attain. Maybe the simple log bridge is the great stone bridge, and vice versa. If that's true, then what Joshu says makes perfect sense. It lets asses cross. It lets horses cross. If your mind is that of an ass, maybe he was implying this monk's mind was sort of on that side of things, then it lets you cross as an ass. If you're a horse, if you're a thoroughbred, it lets you cross as a thoroughbred. If you're walking into the Zendo for the first time and you're wondering, what the hell is all this? This is weird. Then it lets you cross as someone with the mind of someone seeing all this for the first time. And if you've been around a long time, then it lets you cross as someone who's been around a long time. In other words, it's never separate from the simple log bridge that we are. There is no stone bridge separate from our moment-to-moment zazen, from our moment-to-moment driving a car, taking care of a kid, typing on a computer. No stone bridge separate from that, or in the stinky parlance, no enlightenment separate from delusion. So in other words, the good news is that we don't need to look outside ourselves in our life to attain something wonderful. We are the something wonderful. We are Buddha. Our life is the manifestation of Buddha's life. We don't need to look further than that. And we don't need to look further for enlightenment than our own mind as it is at this very moment. Dogen had a wonderful way of expressing this, as he so often does. He says, enlightenment does not divide you just as the moon does not break the water. Enlightenment does not divide you. You are not separate from enlightenment. You are not divided from enlightenment. Just as the water that's reflecting the full moon is not divided by the light of that moon. Therefore, it's not something you have to reach for or grab for. Enlightenment does not divide you, just as the moon does not break the water. You cannot hinder enlightenment, just as a drop of water does not crush the moon in the sky. So, enlightenment can, you know, that old watch commercial, it took a licking and keeps on ticking. Well, that's the way enlightenment is. No matter what state your mind is in, no matter how busy, how anguished, how troubled, you cannot hinder enlightenment. You're like a drop of water reflecting the light of the moon. And no matter what kind of drop of water you are, the moon is going to be fully reflected in the drop of water that you are. You cannot hinder enlightenment just as a drop of water does not crush the moon in the sky. But, he says, the depth of the drop is the height of the moon. So in other words, drops that are large and deep reflect the moon in a certain way. Drops that are small and muddy reflect the moon in a different way. It's not that anything we do, what we do doesn't matter because it's all enlightenment. The depth of the drop is the height of the moon. How much you manifest your enlightened Buddha mind is a function of how deep you go. How deep you go into your practice, how deep you go into your life, how deep you explore your own wisdom and your own compassion. No exploration, no depth, well, you'll be a shallow, teeny little drop of water reflecting the light of the moon. And yet, the moon will be completely reflected in you. If you go deep, if you live deeply, sincerely, profoundly with yourself and with others, then you'll be a deep drop reflecting the moon in those depths. Each reflection, however long or short its duration, manifests the vastness of the dewdrop and realizes the limitlessness of the moonlight in the sky. We don't often think of ourselves as vast dewdrops. We're more likely to identify with the metaphor of the simple log bridge. But if we again refer to our zazen, when we're in our thinking mode, then there's vast and small, deep and shallow, all of that, because that's what thinking is. It's evaluating, comparing. But then when we let go of all that, then there are no comparisons, no evaluations. And we look at things a different way. And then I say, how big is that clock? It's meaningless. The natural answer is, compared to what? If there's no compared to what, then that clock is boundless. Each moment of our life is boundless in just that same way, beyond any comparison. And going deeply into our life in the way that Dogen is talking about is simply realizing the boundlessness of our life as a simple log bridge. And when we realize the boundlessness of our life, the stone bridge immediately appears. They're not two different things. And we can manifest prajna paramita. We can use that bridge to cross to the other shore, which is, of course, the shore we happen to be standing on at this very moment. So, Zen is, the Zen literature is full of these metaphors like the log bridge and the stone bridge. And, you know, people can get kind of frustrated with the koans and the Zen literature, and for very good reason. You know, well, just tell us what the stone bridge is and how we cross the damn fucking thing, right? Just tell us, come on. You got the gold rope, tell us. Well, I believe me, I would, but the problem is that this bridge is empty. And by that, I simply mean it's never the same from one moment to the next. Our minds are constantly changing. Our lives are constantly in transition. With each moment, in a sense, we're dying and being reborn into the next moment. How could the bridge of the Dharma be a solid structure that you could cling to? It's the job of Zen teachers first to sort of put a flashlight on that structure, and then when you go, oh, that's a very nice structure, then they blow it up. And that's why this can be such a frustrating business. It's just inherent in the nature of things that there is no place to land. Although you can rely on this great bridge, absolutely, 100%, you can never put your finger on it and say, oh, this is what it is. because already the finger has changed and the thing you've laid it on has changed. And so the metaphors in Zen are all over the map. Some of you might have attended a senior student ceremony, a shuso ceremony, where the shuso holds up a stick, a shipe, and says, "This is a 6-foot-long black snake." Back in the day of a Buddha, it was a kampora flower on Mount Shorin. So what is it? Is it a flower? Is it a snake? Is it a stick? Depends on the causes and conditions in which it appears. One of the most wonderful stick metaphors in Zen is that of the shujo, where a master says, shujo is a monk's staff. It's like a 6-foot-tall stick. Maybe Joshu used that on his pilgrimage as he was climbing the mountains. And it usually has a little bell on it to warn the little animals that a very dangerous human animal is coming along and you better split. And that koan goes, "If you have a shujo, I'll give you one. If you have a staff, I'll give you a staff. If you don't have a staff, I'll take it from you." This is sort of the same idea as showing the bridge and blowing it up. But then the commentary on this koan, I think, is one of the most beautiful things I've read in the Zen literature. The commentary on this staff or this bridge or whatever the metaphor is says, "It helps you cross the river when the bridge is broken. It guides you back to the village on a moonless night. If you call it a stick, if you call it a bridge, if you call it anything at all, you go to hell as fast as an arrow." Well, why? For the simple reason is that as soon as you call it something, you've separated from it. That's what makes this practice so hard. We don't believe we are the Dharma, that our hearts are Buddha hearts, that our minds are Buddha minds, and that we are the embodiment of Manjushri and Avalokiteshvara. We are the complete manifestation of wisdom and compassion in this Saha world, this world of effort and suffering and endurance. This simple log bridge is the great stone bridge.